out into the soccer field. The big truck backed 50 yards from the chapel, then slammed to a stop. Jamie had put a spiderweb fracture in the windshield on the driver's side, and Harper had a sudden thought. Jamie had managed to hurt Jacob, had taken something out of him, had maybe even come close to killing him. Allie dropped the rifle and sank to a crouch. "I'm out," she yelled. "No more bullets." The handles of the fire ladder bumped into sight as it made its slow, hitching way up to the railing. The fireman stood, rocking a little on his heels, reached over the side, and steadied it. "Go. Down. Now. You first," the fireman said, nodding at Harper. "Nick," she said. "Allie will have to take him on her back." "I've got him," Allie said, crawling around the catwalk to Nick. On the other side of the church, the freight liner began to move, rumbling toward the base of the bell tower. Harper didn't like heights, and the thought of putting her leg over the side made her feel dizzy. But she was already straddling the railing, reaching with one bare foot for the first rung. She glanced over her shoulder, searching for the ladder, and saw the fire engine 40 feet below, looking small enough to pick up with one hand. And for a moment it seemed to her the entire bell tower was nodding like a flower, about to dump her. She clenched her hands on the stone railing and shut her eyes. "You can do this, Harper," the fireman said, and kissed her cheek. She nodded. She wanted to say something cute and daring, but she couldn't swallow, let alone speak. Harper swung her other leg over the side. She moved her right foot down to the second rung, let go of the stone railing, grabbed wildly, got her hands on the ladder. The whole thing wobbled unsteadily beneath her. On the far side of the building, she heard the distinct sound of the freight liner chunking into a new gear as it sped up. She had descended not more than 5 rungs when the fireman helped Allie over the side, Nick clinging to her back. Allie scrambled after Harper, wearing Nick as lightly as she might have worn a backpack for school. The fireman put a leg over the railing, planted one boot on the top rung. His other foot found the second rung. He reached down and put one hand on the ladder itself, stood there clinging to the very, very top of it. The freight liner hit the north side of the chapel, doing nearly 50 miles an hour. It turned at the last instant, swiping away the entire front corner of the church, throwing enough wood and stone and glass to fill a dump truck. The steeple lurched, steadied for a moment, and caved in. One moment it was there, the next it wasn't. It dropped in on itself, the stone railing, the balusters, the bell tower roof, the beams, the wooden catwalk. It collapsed with a wrenching boom that Harper felt in her chest, like a throb in the blood. All at once the top of the fire ladder swung in empty air. John Rookwood hung suspended at the pinnacle. A black gush of smoke spun up from the ruin, obscuring him in a whirl of spark-filled darkness. A blast of cold wind that smelled of the sea carried some of that smoke away a moment later, and the fireman was gone. Harper opened her mouth to scream, but then her gaze found him, already 10 rungs down from the top, and making his way hand over hand toward the earth below. The ladder shook and bounced in the open air. Allie was moving so quickly she was almost stepping on Harper's hands. Harper made her effortful way toward the engine below. Lower down, the ladder still had some roof to lean against. The southern half of the church remained intact. Harper didn't know that she had reached the roof of the truck until she felt metal under her bare feet. She stepped off the ladder on shaking legs and looked around for Renee. She wasn't on top of the engine anymore, had climbed down at some point. Now Harper felt shivery and weak, cold even in her bones. The shuddering was moving from her legs to the rest of her body. Her first thought was that she was going into shock. Then it occurred to her it might be something else entirely. John had said casting flame used up calories and oxygen, and afterward you were dazed and ill and could easily get into trouble if you didn't find a place to rest. She went unsteadily to the rear of the truck, where there was an old short ladder of rusted iron. She climbed down it to the bumper and stepped off, and her legs collapsed on her without warning. She sat ungracefully in the wet grass. Sparks and smoke whirled slowly above her, like a carousel coming to a halt. She forced the feeling of weakness back and used the bumper to stand.
"Oh, you cunt! My hand! My hand!"
Harper came around the side of the fire engine, moving toward the screaming. The Marlboro man was on his back in the grass, arching his spine and digging his heels into the mud. He looked like he was trying to push his way across the dirt on his back. He held his right wrist with his left hand. There was no right hand. There was only a broken bit of pink bone sticking out where the hand belonged. Harper stepped over him to get to Renee, who was leaning in the open driver's side door. When Harper got there, Renee was cradling Gilbert Klein in her arms. Blood still leaked from the bullet wound in his neck, but without much enthusiasm. There was blood all over the front seat. Harper noticed, almost absently, a severed hand, still clutching a gun, set carefully in on the dash. Renee had thoughtfully picked it up and put it where the Marlboro man couldn't go after it in an attempt to get his Glock back. "We were almost to the end of Watership Down," Renee said. "Gil said he never thought he could like a story about talking animals so much. I said life was strange. I never expected to fall in love with a man who stole cars." She was not weeping and spoke with great clarity. "He hot-wired the truck. We couldn't find the keys. While he was doing it, he told me he was just more proof that most criminals went right back to what they knew best as soon as they got out. He said he was sorry to be adding to the recidivism rate. It took me a moment to realize he was joking. He was very dry. He didn't even smile at his own jokes, let alone laugh at them. Didn't give you any clues he was being funny. Oh, Harper, I don't want to try and live without him. I feel like I spent my whole life unable to taste food. Then Gil came to camp, and suddenly everything had flavor. Everything was delicious. And then that awful man shot him. And Gil is dead. And I'll have to go back to not being able to taste things again. I don't know if I can do that." Harper wished there was something to say. Maybe there was, and she was just too wobbly and lightheaded to think what. Instead, she put her arm around Renee and clumsily kissed her ear. Renee closed her eyes and lowered her head and wept in a very quiet, private way. The Marlboro man shrieked. Harper turned and saw Allie standing over him. Allie had her brother in her arms again. She had paused, Harper thought, to kick the Marlboro man in the ribs. "Oh, you fucking bitch, you're gonna burn, and I'm gonna jack off on your charred fucking tits," the Marlboro man said. "You wanna jack off?" Allie said. "You're gonna have to learn how to do it with your left hand, Stumpy."
"I don't think you should live," Renee said, wiping her face. "Not when so many other people are dead. It doesn't seem fair."
"Do you want me to kill him?" the fireman said. Harper hadn't realized he was on the ground, standing behind her. He was swaying himself and looked as bad, maybe worse, than she felt. Sweat crawled on his wasted white face. His eyes, though, were as dark as crow feathers and perfectly serene. He put a hand on the fire axe that leaned against the side of the truck. Renee thought it over, then shook her head.
"No, I guess not. I suppose I'm very weak and foolish. Not to get even while I can."
"It makes you the furthest thing from weak I can imagine," the fireman said. He looked back at Allie, who had joined them. "You'll have to drive the fire truck, Allie. And you'll have to find somewhere you can hide all of you, somewhere nearby. I'll meet up with you later." "What are you talking about?" Harper asked him. "You are coming with us." "Not now. Soon." "That's crazy. John, you can't be on your own. You can hardly stand." He waved this notion away, shook his head. "I'm not seeing double anymore. That has to be a sign of progress." And when he saw her expression, he insisted, "I am not abandoning you. Any of you. I swear I'll be with you in no more than a day, two at most."
"How will you find us?" Harper asked.
"Nick will send for me," the fireman said, looking over Allie's shoulder into Nick's swollen, filthy, dazed face. The fireman did something with his hands, moving them here and there. Nick blinked slowly and seemed to nod. Harper thought the fireman had said something about birds.
Renee said, "We'll have to squeeze in with Gil. I hope that's all right. I won't leave him here."
"No," Harper said. "Of course you won't." Renee nodded, then climbed up on the running board and gently eased Gilbert aside, making room behind the steering wheel. The fireman turned and strode across the matted grass. He crouched over the Marlboro man.
"You," the Marlboro man said. "I know who you are. You're going to die. My man Jacob is going to spread your faggot British ass all over the road. He's going to paint the highway with you. Jacob loves killing the burners. He says it's the first thing in his life he's ever done really well. But he's looking forward to doing you most of all. He wants to do it while she watches."
"Jacob likes finishing off burners, does he?" the fireman asked. He lifted his left hand and a trickle of green flame fluttered like a silk ribbon from the tip of his index finger. The fireman gazed into it in a sleepy, speculative way, then blew it out, leaving the tip of his finger gray with ash. The fireman lowered his hand and spread the ash across the Marlboro man's forehead, drawing a cross. The Marlboro man flinched.
"Well, you better get up and get moving then, soon as you can, because you're one of us now, friend. That ash is full of my poison. Maybe, if you're lucky, you'll find a few other people who are infected who will shelter you and look after you, as the folk in this camp once did for us. Maybe, but I doubt it. I think most people will close their doors in your face the moment you open your big mouth to ask for their help. You have a quite recognizable voice."
The Marlboro man kicked his feet against the ground and slid 6 inches across the dirt, shaking his head frantically, and began to shriek.
"No! No, no, no! You can't! You can't! Listen to me! Listen!"
"Actually," the fireman said, "I think I've heard more than enough. The only thing worse than listening to men like you on the radio is meeting you in real life. Because out here in the world, there's just no simple way to change the station." And he kicked him, lightly, almost humorously, under the jaw. The Marlboro man's head snapped back and his teeth clapped shut on the tip of his tongue, and his scream became a high, hideous, inchoate keening. The fireman started away, staggering a little, his coat flapping about him.
"If I don't see you by tomorrow night," Harper shouted at him, "I'll come looking for you."
He glanced back over his shoulder and gave her a crooked smile.
"Just when I thought I was out of the frying pan. Try not to worry. I'll be with you again soon enough."
"Come on, Miss Willows," Allie said. Allie was in the truck now, behind the steering wheel, hand on the door and leaning out to look down at her.
"We have to go. There's still men with guns out there. There's still that plow."
Harper jerked her head in a nod, then cast her gaze around for a last look at John. But he wasn't there. The smoke had claimed him. 11. The fire truck bashed aside the wreck of the Chevy Intimidator with an almost casual indifference, sent it spinning toward the circle of stones. It struck one of the monoliths with a ringing clang. Marty Castleman was approaching the overturned Chevy when the fire engine struck it. He dived out of the way, but the Uzi in his right hand went off in a chattering blast, and the spray blew off 3 of his toes. The big freightliner was backing away from the half-collapsed bonfire that had once been a chapel. The driver saw the fire truck banging away up the hill, but by the time Jacob got the freightliner turned around, his wife, Renee Gilmanton, and the 2 children with them were long gone. 12. Allie pulled the truck to a stop where the dirt lane met Little Harbor Road.
"Where to now?" she asked.
Harper looked out the passenger side window toward the rusting blue hulk of the school bus. The headlights were on. A skinny girl of about 15, with a shaved head, slumped behind the steering wheel. Someone had left a machete in the back of her skull. Nick reached up to touch Harper's chin, physically turning her head toward him. He was sitting in her lap. He stank of burnt hair, and it looked as if he had gone bobbing for apples in red Kool-Aid. His face was so stained and sticky with blood. But his eyes were more alert now. He spoke with his hands.
"Nick says he knows a place we can go," Harper said, then narrowed her eyes.
She replied with some gestures of her own.
What place?
Trust me, Nick told her in sign language. It's safe. No one will find us. It's where I hid everything I stole. He met her gaze with a haunted solemnity. I'm the thief. Book 9. Engine. 1. In the minutes after midnight, as March became April, the fire engine rushed along Little Harbor Road, following it all the way to where it ended at Sagamore Avenue. Nick gestured for Allie to turn right. They had gone less than a mile before Nick began to signal for her to stop. Allie turned into the entrance of South Street Cemetery, a graveyard as old as the colonies and half a mile wide. She stopped in front of the black gates, which were held shut by a length of heavy chain and padlock. Nick opened the passenger door and leaped out of Harper's lap. Nick gripped the chain in one hand and bowed his head. Liquid metal hissed and dripped between his fingers into the dirt. The chain fell apart in two sections, and he pushed the gate open, his hand still smoking. Allie drove through and then waited. Nick reached back through the bars, wound the two halves of the chain into a loose knot, and gripped it firmly. There was more smoke, and his eyes were as red as coals, and when he let go, he had welded the links together again. South Street Cemetery was a kind of city, in which most of the residences were located underground. Nick guided them along its streets and alleys, its winding suburbs and open pastures. They continued until they had reached the dirt road that ran along the back of the cemetery. A second, more modest sort of graveyard awaited in the wet grass and underbrush. A dozen cars in various states of collapse, filthy, burnt out, sitting on their rims. Several were half-submerged in weeds, islands of rust in a shallow sea of poisoned sumac. To one side of this final resting place for unmourned cars was a squat and ugly cement building with a tin roof. Cobwebbed windows peeked out from under the eaves. At one end of the building was a pair of corrugated aluminum garage doors. The center of operations for the grounds crew, Harper surmised, back in the days when South Street Cemetery still had a grounds crew. The knee-high grass growing right up to the front steps suggested it had been a while since anyone punched their card for work. Out beyond the wrecks was a wide sandy pit, some kind of debris piled into it, hidden under overlapping brown plastic tarps. Allie parked the truck between the hole and a Pontiac Firebird that had cooked down to the frame. She hunted around under the steering wheel, found a couple of bare wires twisted together, and pulled them apart with a buzzing snap of electricity. The fire engine chugged, thudded, and died. They sat in the stillness. Through the oaks at the rear of the park, Harper could see a flat bay, a pebbly strand, and some darkened buildings on the far side of the water. Come to South Street Cemetery. Beachside views available. Quiet neighbors. This is only good until the sun comes up. Then this truck will be visible from the air, Renee said. Harper looked at the garage doors of the building for the grounds crew and wondered if there was enough room in there for an antique fire truck. Nick let himself out of her lap again, throwing open the door. He hopped into blowing mist. I don't think this is far enough from Camp Wyndham either, Renee went on. Her voice had a dull, disinterested quality. She sat on Harper's left, holding Gilbert in her arms. He was between her legs, his head lolling against her shoulder, and her arms were around his waist. There's a path in the woods. It's only 15 minutes from here to the archery range. I walked here once or twice myself last summer.
But it's almost 4 miles by the road, Allie said. And they'd expect us to keep driving. No, I think this might do if we can get the truck under... What's he up to?
Unbuckling and letting herself out. Nick had clambered into the sandy pit. He pulled back one flap of a tarp to reveal a midden heap of shriveled flowers, blackened wreaths, and mildewed teddy bears. Even grief, it seemed, had an expiration date. Allie caught up to him, found another corner of the tarp, and helped him drag it toward the fire truck. They would only need a couple of them to hide the engine completely. Harper got down, put her hands in the small of her back, and stretched, popping her spine. She ached as if she were recovering from flu, every muscle sore, every joint achy. She looked back into the truck at Renee. "We're going to cover the truck and go inside." When Renee didn't reply, Harper added, "I think you should get out now." Renee lifted her shoulders in a weary sigh. "All right. Will Allie help me carry Gil inside?" Allie and Nick had by then dragged the tarp to the side of the truck. Allie stiffened and darted an uneasy look at Harper. Harper nodded to her, just slightly. "Of course I will, Miss Gilmanton," Allie said, in a tone of insouciance that didn't jive with her pale look of dismay. Easing the heavy corpse of Gilbert Klein out of the fire truck was a clumsy bit of business. Renee held him under the armpits and heaved and gasped, nudging him toward the passenger door a few inches at a time. Allie got him by the ankles, and they began to shift him out, but Renee bumped her head and lost her grip, and the top half of his body dropped all of a sudden. His head bonged against the step up into the cab. Renee made a shrill yelp of horror and almost fell out after him. "Oh, no," she said. "Oh, no, oh, no, oh, Gil, I'm so weak. I'm so useless." "Hush now," Harper said, moving past Renee and bending to get Gil under the arms herself.
"You can't," Renee said. "Don't, Harper. You're 9 months pregnant."
"It's no trouble at all," Harper said, although when she straightened up, her ankles blazed and her back twinged. They walked Gilbert through high weeds, wet grass shushing against his back. His head lolled. He wore a stoic, almost patient look, his clear, quite blue eyes seeming to watch Harper the whole time. They had to put the dead man down when they reached the corner of the garage, so Harper could rest and Allie could look for a way in. The door was locked, and there was no key under the mat or beneath either of the ceramic flower pots on the front steps, pots full of dirt and a flourishing crop of decorative weeds. But Nick didn't mean to enter by way of the door. He made his way along the side of the building, peering up under the eaves. At last he stopped and gestured to one of the windows. It was a good 5 feet over his head. So high up under the eaves it was hard to imagine it let in any daylight. The window was a long, narrow slot, and a triangular piece of glass was missing from one smashed pane. No man could put his hand through the gap, but a child's arm just might fit. Nick needed Allie to hunch down so he could climb onto her shoulders. Even when she rose to her full height, he could barely reach the glass. He had to stretch to get a hand in through the window and turn the lock. He pushed it open, grabbed the sill, hoisted himself up, and disappeared headfirst into the darkness. There must have been something just inside the window to climb down on, some shelving perhaps, because Harper didn't hear him drop. He was gone without a sound. "I wonder who helped him get in there last time," Harper said, and when Allie gave her a questioning look, she nodded at the high window. "He's obviously done this before, but he's too short to reach the window on his own." Allie frowned. The front door popped open and Nick stuck his head out and waved for them to come along, come in. His house was their house. 2. When day broke, the engine was completely covered by a pair of tarps, one over the front, another over the rear. Harper had imagined they might be able to put the fire truck inside, but the garage already contained a John Deere and a backhoe. An orderly if cobwebbed collection of rakes and shovels hung from hooks on one wall. An expansive work table ran the length of the other. That was where they put Gilbert, covering him with a third tarp. At the back of the garage, a bank of windows looked into a cluttered office. 2 desks, a corkboard on the wall, an empty water cooler, and a couch the creamy green hue of snot. That was where they slept. Harper took the couch. Allie and Nick slept in each other's arms on the floor, wrapped in a gray blanket that Allie found in a back compartment of the fire truck. Renee didn't join them. She sat on a stool beside the work table, holding Gilbert's hand. Sometimes she talked to him. Sometimes she laughed, as if he had said something clever. Often she just moved her thumb across his knuckles, or pressed his cold hand to her cheek. Nick had told Harper he was the thief, and promised to take her to where he had stashed the loot. but the portable mother was nowhere in sight. The same went for all the other little valuables that had gone missing from camp. Harper assumed Nick would explain when he was ready. She curled up on her side under a black windbreaker. The jacket had a print of Death himself on the back, one skeletal hand clutching a scythe, and the other raising a lacy bra. "Gravediggers Local 13, bad to the bone," it said. The windbreaker smelled of coffee and menthol and made her think of her father, who was always smearing Ben Gay on his bad neck. She cried herself to sleep, thinking about her dad, who might be dead now, and who she doubted she would ever see again in her life. But she wept quietly, not wanting to disturb anyone else. When she woke, the children were yet asleep. Was Allie still a child? Looking at her smooth cheek and long eyelashes, Harper wanted to think so. Even in sleep, though, she had a whittled-down quality that made her look very much like a young woman, worn by her cares and worries, too busy to think the things that made children happy. Harper gazed through one of the picture windows facing the garage and saw Renee had climbed up onto the plywood table and dozed off against Gil, one plump hand resting on his chest. The high windows under the eaves looked out on featureless darkness. Harper had slumbered through the day and might have slept through much of the next night if she weren't so hungry. They would have to do something about food soon. The office had a formica counter with a sink, a microwave, a Mr. Coffee, and a radio that was so old it had a cassette player built into the front. It was plugged into a wall socket, but of course there was no power. There was a fridge, but Harper didn't look inside, didn't want to smell what might be in there. She turned the radio around and found a battery compartment in the back. It required 6 big D batteries. There was a package of fresh D cells in the third drawer she tried. Harper carried the radio out of the office and into the cool, stony quiet of the garage. She paused at the workbench beside Renee and Gil. The tarp had slipped down to their waists. Gil's shirt was unbuttoned slightly, and Renee's hand was curled on his chest, her cheek against his shoulder. Written in faded blue letters, ornate, almost gothic, across Gil's chest, were 2 lines. "It is impossible to go through life without trust. That is to be imprisoned in the worst cell of all, oneself. G. Green." Harper lifted the tarp up, smoothing it over the two of them, and left them to each other. She settled on the cement step in a night of surprising, almost liquid warmth, filled with cricket song. She flexed her toes in the damp, gritty loam. When she tipped back her head and looked into the sky, she saw so many stars, it made her ache with love for the world. And what a thing that she still loved the world, even now. The face of the radio glowed a lightning bug green. What was better than a warm spring night, bare feet in the warm dirt, the smell of budding trees in the air, and a little music on the radio? All she was missing was a cold beer. She dialed through the FM bands, hoping to hear Martha Quinn and knowing she wouldn't. She didn't. Through a hiss of static, she brought in a station playing archival recordings of black gospel, but after a few songs it faded out. Farther down the dial, she found a young man, or was it a kid? His voice had the high-pitched, strained quality that Harper associated with incipient puberty, reporting from Red Sox spring training in Fort Myers. She stuck there for a while, pulse thudding heavily, shaken by the thought that baseball was going on somewhere in the world. But after half an inning, she began to suspect the kid of making it all up as he went along. Bill Buckner was playing first base again, over 25 years since his last game, and every single ball went between his legs. Vin Diesel was batting as the Red Sox's designated hitter and stroked a ball right at a shortstop named Kermit DeFrock. When DeFrock caught it, the force of the hit pulled his arm out of its socket. The Sox were playing a team called the Heretics, largely made up of Muppets, Monsters, and Madmen, who erupted into flames and died on the field whenever they made an error. Harper listened, smiling, for another inning. The Sox were up 3.5-1 when she changed the station. She wasn't sure how they had scored half a run. The kid doing the announcing sounded about 11, and like he was having the time of his life. Down at the very bottom of the dial, she found a boys' choir singing, "O Come All Ye Faithful," and stopped to listen. And at some point she realized she was crying. She had not wanted any of them to die, not a single one, and it didn't matter how hard it had been to live with them. When the song faded out, a woman began a report, "Today in Blessings." It was news of a sort. She said word had come in that J.K. Rowling, author of the godless Harry Potter novels, had been killed by firing squad in Edinburgh. Her execution had been televised on what remained of the web. She was scribbled all over with the devil's handwriting, and had used her money and status to protect and transport others who were sick. When offered the chance to ask forgiveness for her many sins, deluding children, hiding the contaminated, she scorned the opportunity and said she would not apologize for a single adverb. The announcer accounted it a blessing that she would burn eternally in hell. Praise Jesus. In local blessings, the National Guard, supported by the Seacoast Incinerators, a volunteer militia, had discovered 600 infected sinners hiding on the grounds of Camp Wyndham. A pitched battle ensued, ending when the sick burned to death in a church they had converted to a heavily armed compound. Say hallelujah. Further north, new fires had started in the south of Maine, but in a sign of the Lord's mercy, the blaze was contained to a mere 20-mile swath. The New Hampshire Soldiers for Christ had pledged to send more than 100 men and a dozen fire trucks within the week. Grand Corporal Ian Judas Killer was in close communication with the Maine Forest Services and stood ready to help any who heard and accepted the truth of his own divine revelations. Glory be! Grand Corporal. His former title had been Governor, but then his former name had been Ian Judd Skiller. The boys' choir returned to sing something in Latin. When Harper lifted her gaze, Nick sat on the other end of the step, squeezing his knees to his chest. "Nice out," she said, but with gestures, not her voice. "I love a warm night, almost like summer." He nodded, just a little, his chin hovering right above his knees. "Eat, we have to," she said, knowing she wasn't getting it quite right. "I'll find eat. Bring here. Don't worry if me not back soon." He shook his head. "I know where there's food," he told her with his eloquent, expressive hands. "Come on." He pushed himself up and led her into the graveyard. 3. For a while they followed the road that ran along the back of the cemetery. Then Nick turned in among the headstones, through the waist-high grass. The boy paused at an old, rough, grayish slab of rock with the name McDaniels upon it. He squatted down and touched the edge. Harper saw a dash of bright red paint. He turned and went on, and she followed. At a blue marble slab commemorating the life of one Ernest Grapeseed, Nick bent, pointed to another little red line, then looked meaningfully back at her. Nick fingerspelled, "Nail polish." Harper remembered then one of the first things to go missing, a bottle of red nail polish that had belonged to the neighbor's sisters. Each believed the other had swiped it, and there had been a nasty fight. He led her up and down the rumpled green earth. The grass was growing long throughout the cemetery. Harper thought by mid-June, all but the highest plinths would be sunk deep beneath a riot of wild green. That didn't seem so bad to her. She thought there was more beauty in wild flowers and tufts of beech grass than there was in a whole park of groomed lawn. They came to a crypt, the walls of white stone buried under vines of ivy and oily green leaves. A captain's wheel had been stamped into the lead door, above the name O'Brien. A chunk of rock, with another little dash of fingernail polish on it, held the door slightly ajar. Nick put a shoulder to. The door slid inward with a grinding shriek. There was no light to see by, and Harper wished she had brought a flashlight. There had to be one back in the garage, but Nick moved quickly around to one of the stone caskets against the wall. His fingertip ignited, spilling a ribbon of bluish-green fire. He touched it to a series of candles, most of which had been melted down to deformed stubs, then shook the flame out. Harper's carpetbag sat on one of the caskets. Allie's gold locket hung from the handle. Harper felt funny all through her middle, seeing the portable mother again. It was like running into someone she had fancied a long time ago, in high school, perhaps, and discovering he was just as good-looking as she remembered. A giant teacup, the size of a soup bowl, sat on another stone coffin lid. Emily Waterman's special cup of stars. The inside was crusted with ancient gobbets of dried meat. Stacked against the wall were three cans of Spam, three cans of condensed milk. The boy hitched himself up to sit with candles on either side of him. Harper sat across from him, inclined her head, and waited. "I was trying to catch the cat," he said with his hands. "A big cat with stripes like a tiger. When I stroked him, I could feel him humming like a small motor. I can't hear purring, but I can feel it, and nothing feels better. But when I tried to capture him, he always got away. Once I had him trapped in a box and carried him halfway back to camp. But he pushed his head out through the bottom and jumped away." She nodded to show she was with him so far. "Michael said he'd help me catch it. It was supposed to be a secret. We'd catch him together and bring him back to camp, and I could keep it. Mike told me to sneak Spam and milk out of the cafeteria. He met me with things he took out of camp, like soda and candy bars. I asked if we'd get in trouble, and he said not if no one found out. I knew we were being bad kids. I felt sorry, sometimes. But it was nice, too. Michael was paying attention to you," Harper said, moving her hands very deliberately to be sure she said exactly what she meant. Nick nodded, with an eagerness that broke her heart a little. "Most of the other kids never seemed to even notice I was there. None of them understood sign language, and I can't follow spoken conversation. I'd sit with them in the cafeteria, but most of the time I couldn't figure out what they were talking about. If they all laughed, I'd smile, like I knew what was funny, even though I didn't. They could have been making jokes about me, for all I knew." He lowered his head, looked at his hands. They twitched, made little motions, and Harper thought, with a flush of surprise and pleasure and sadness, that he was talking to himself, and those little finger wiggles were his version of a whisper. At last he lifted his chin and met her gaze and began to speak again. "Mike didn't know sign language, but we wrote each other notes. He was really good about waiting for me to finish writing when I had a lot to say. He could sit there just swinging his feet for 5 minutes while I scribbled away. Most people aren't very patient. He helped me build traps for the cat. Some of our traps were really funny, right out of comic books. One time we stole a camouflage windbreaker and stretched it out over a pit and covered it with leaves, like maybe the cat would be stupid enough to fall in." Harper remembered the day a camouflage windbreaker had gone missing. It had belonged to a teenage girl named Nellie Lance, who had been miffed and baffled by its disappearance. "There are literally 10,000 nicer coats she could have stolen," Nellie said. She. They had always believed the thief was a woman. Everything that disappeared went missing from the kitchens or the girls' dorm. But of course there was one male in the girls' dorm. Nick had spent the entire autumn there, sharing a bed, at first with his sister, then later jumping into Harper's cot with her. Nick went on. "Everything we stole from camp, we hid here. I used the nail polish to make a trail, so we could always find our way to the stash. Sometimes we broke into the garage for the grounds crew. Mike figured out he could put me up on his shoulders, and I could get in through the window." "People got angry," Harper said. "When you knew people angry, why no tell? You could have explained all, and no one mad." "You're going to think I'm an idiot."
"Try me."
"I didn't know anyone was even looking for a thief, Not for a long, long time. Everyone was talking about it, but no one was talking to me. People made announcements in chapel that I couldn't hear. I asked Mike sometimes what everyone was talking about, but he always said it was nothing. Once, Allie was so angry she was shaking, and I asked her why, and she told me some bitch was stealing from the girls' dorm. I was such a big dummy, I didn't even know she was talking about me. I thought someone else was stealing things. Important things. Stuff that really mattered. I only took nail polish and a stupid teacup and Spam. Everyone hated Spam. He lowered his eyes. And once I took Allie's locket. Then he looked up, a bright challenge in his eyes. But only because it was supposed to be my locket, too. We were supposed to share. But Allie said lockets are for girls, and so she kept it all to herself and never let me wear it or even look at it. What about Portable Mother? Harper asked. He rested his chin against his chest and blinked. Tears plopped on his thighs. I'm sorry.
Don't sorry. Tell why.
Mike said it was big enough to put the cat in it. He said it would be really useful for a trap, and we could give it back to you later. I wasn't going to take all the stuff in it, too, not at first. I was going to empty it out and just take the bag. But then I remembered my Viewmaster.
What?
He twisted around and popped the carpet bag's gold clasp. He fished around inside and came up with a red plastic Viewmaster. I remember. Carol gave me, Harper said, for baby. His face darkened. It wasn't hers to give. It was mine. Aunt Carol told me one day I was too old for it, and then she gave it to you. She told me to be a big boy about it, so I took the whole bag. I stole it, even though you're my friend, and it was really bad. He swiped at his eyes with one hand. The muscles under his face trembled with the force of barely contained emotion. After I took it, I wanted to give it back. I really did. Michael met me here in the tomb and said we couldn't risk it. He said Father Story had announced that the person who stole the Portable Mother would have to leave camp forever. He said stealing from a pregnant woman was the worst sin this side of murder. Mike told me I couldn't even return it in secret because Ben Patchett would fingerprint it. And Allie told me whoever took the locket was going to have her hands cut off. Even still, I thought I could tell Father's story what I had done. I was going to, as soon as he got back from rescuing the prisoners with the firemen. And then... His hand stopped moving for a bit, while he rubbed the balls of his palms into his eyes. Soon, though, his fingers began to move again. Mike said maybe it was lucky for me Father's story got smashed in the head. He said he was pretty sure Father's story suspected me. He said before Father Story got his head crunched, he warned Mike he was going to have to ask me some tough questions about the things that had been stolen, and if I didn't answer them right, he'd probably have to send me and Allie both away, forever and ever. Mike said Father Story would get rid of us both because it was Allie's job to make sure I behaved. And Father Story also said it was important that the camp knew he wouldn't treat me different just because I was his grandson.
He lie. Lie bad. Father Story never hurt you or sister. He never let anyone else hurt you. She could see Nick didn't want to look at her, didn't want to make eye contact. But it was the curse of the death that they could not hide their eyes if they wanted to communicate. He had to keep his gaze on her hands. He blinked at tears and dragged the back of one arm across his nose.
I know now, but I was scared. And that's why I stayed with you in the infirmary. So if Father Story woke up, I could tell him I was sorry and ask him to please not punish Allie for anything I did. And Mike said that was a good idea, and he'd hang around the infirmary, too, as much as he could. That way, if Father Story woke up, he could take most of the blame. Mike said he ought to accept most of the responsibility anyway, because he was older.
Not you fault, Harper told him with her hands. Michael was a liar. He fooled all of us.
Nick's shoulders hitched convulsively. He He lifted his hands and dropped them, lifted them and tried again.
I woke up once and got up to go to the bathroom and found Mike bending over Father Story's feet. He was surprised to see me and stood up really fast and looked scared, and he had a needle in his hand. I asked him what he was doing, and he said he had come by to give himself his insulin shot, and then he stopped to say a prayer over Father Story. He was trying to kill Father Story, wasn't he?
Yes. When happened?
February.
Harper thought back and nodded. Father Story stopped having fits in February. That's when he start getting better. After the fit stopped.
You saved Father Story's life. You scared Mike after you caught him with needle. He didn't try poison again.
Nick shook his head.
I didn't save him. Michael still killed him.
Harper leaned forward and put her elbows on her knees. But not before Father Story woke and tell you how much he loved you. You understand? You were very love. You are not no bad boy.
Nick looked so disconsolate, she had to get up and kiss his head and give him a squeeze.
When she let go of him, he was at least not crying anymore.
She said, Do you think that can with meat still good? It was never good, but we can probably eat it.
Harper gathered up the Spam and condensed milk in both arms. When she turned around, Nick stood before her, wearing the locket around his neck and holding the portable mother open wide. She nodded in approval and rocked the cans inside. They slid themselves out into the darkness and started back the way they had come. They had not gone more than 100 feet, though, when Harper heard the whine and roar of a big and familiar engine, a sound that made her insides clump nervously together. She grabbed Nick's shirt sleeve and pulled him down to a crouch behind a Virgin Mary. The orange plow rumbled past out in the street, spoiling the night with its diesel stink. It moved slowly, and a searchlight mounted to the top of the cab dipped and swayed, flashing over the stone wall and into the graveyard. 10-foot-long shadows of angels and crosses lunged across the grass toward Harper, then retreated. She let out a long, unsteady breath. Still out there. Still looking. He knew what they had fled in. Maybe he knew they hadn't gone far. A fire truck was not the world's most discreet getaway car. She turned to look at Nick, and was surprised to find the boy grinning broadly. He wasn't peering toward the street, but instead was staring intently across the gravel road that bordered the back of the cemetery, watching something in the high, tangled undergrowth. Harper saw ferns twitch as something slipped away.
What? She asked him with her hands.
The cat, he told her. I just saw the cat. It survived the winter, too.
4. Harper was prepared to step between Allie and Nick, was ready for threats, tears, and flying furniture. But Allie did not seem even a little surprised to see the portable mother again, or to find Nick wearing her locket. When they re-entered the office, Allie sat on the edge of the couch, rubbing her face with both hands. She looked at them with blurred eyes and asked no questions. Harper took a can of Spam out of her carpet bag and hunted in the cupboard for something to spread it on. She discovered a box of saltines and felt a twang of gratitude that approached the spiritual. Nick planted himself in front of Allie, chin stuck out, waiting for her to say something. She did, at last, finger spelling only.
I guess you can wear it. I thought it would make you look like a little girl, but at least you're a cute girl.
Harper found a cassette, The Rolling Stones' Aftermath, and punched it in the cassette player. Mick Jagger warned his baby, baby, baby that she was out of time. Just about, Harper thought. Harper gave Allie the shorter version of what Nick had told her in the tomb, while she spread gelatinous Spam on crackers. Allie did not interrupt or cross-examine. When Harper had finished, and they were all sitting on the couch together, eating pasty meat, Allie used her fingers to say,
I can't believe you fell for Mike's BS about fingerprints. That's pretty dumb, even for you.
Nick said,
I know. But by the time I started to think Michael was wrong about fingerprints, There was snow on the ground, and no one could leave camp, so there was no way for me to bring anything back without leaving footprints. Besides, you were the dummy who told me when they found the thief, Ben was going to cut off his hands in front of the whole camp.
She nodded.
Don't sweat it. You're just 9. You're supposed to be dumb. I'm 17. What's my excuse?
When had Allie turned 17, Harper wondered. And then it crossed her mind she had missed her own birthday, 4 weeks before.
How long will the spam hold out? Allie asked.
She slurred a little. Her upper lip was ugly, split in 2 halves where Jamie had slashed her mouth. Harper needed to poke around for a needle and thread. 2 cans.
Good, because it will be sweet mercy when it's gone and we can starve to death in peace.
I was hoping to avoid that, Harper said, and began to speak to Nick again with her hands.
The fireman said you can find him and show him where we are. If I have to.
You have to.
I'd need to throw fire. I don't like to.
I know you don't. He gave her a wary, haunted look.
Did John tell you why?
Harper nodded. Allie looked slowly back and forth between Harper and Nick. Harper was going to try and speak to him with her hands, but this time sign language wouldn't do. She got up and hunted in the drawers and came back with a pad of paper and a ballpoint pen. What happened was not your fault. It takes a minimum of 6 weeks for the spore to reach the part of the brain that makes controlling it possible. Maybe longer. Your mother wanted to animate fire, the way John does with his phoenix, or you did last night with your little birds. But her brain wasn't ready. What she did was like inducing labor before a baby is prepared to survive outside the womb. Instead of a child, you get a miscarriage. But she didn't know. Neither of you did. This is not your fault. Or hers. It was a shitty accident. That's all. But he shook his head, folded the note once, twice, and pushed it down into his pocket. His face, swollen from crying, pink where he had burned himself, filthy and still bloodstained, had nothing like ease or acceptance in it.
You don't know, he said with his hands. You don't have any idea.
Before she could reply, he pushed off the couch with both fists and went to the door out into the garage. He looked back.
You coming or not? He asked with his hands.
He led them behind the building. A pulsating harmonic filled the night, seemed to make the air itself vibrate, the shared song of 1,000 crickets. Nick moved away from them, into the high grass. He paced in a circle, tramping the grass flat. Wet weeds squealed under his sneakers. He went around and around, going faster and faster, his head swinging back and forth. His fingers danced and played, and Harper thought he was singing without a song, listening to a melody that had no sound, asking for what he wanted without words. It was a little frightening, watching him go about like a figurine in a silent music box, lurching along its track. His eyes were closed, then they weren't. They snapped open, peepholes into a furnace. His fingers trailed orange sparks. He lifted his left hand, and flame trailed off it. Little flames sheared from his fingers, fluttering into the air. But instead of shrinking and vanishing, they took shape, became dainty birds of fire. A burning flock of them fell streaming from his blazing hand, and shot this way and that, spinning like rockets into the night. 1 dozen, 2 dozen, 100.
My God, said Renee, who had come to the back door to watch. How come they don't just burn up and vanish? What are they using for fuel?
Him, Allie said and nodded at her brother. He's the kindling and the firewood both, the lighter fluid and the match.
No, that isn't right, Harper said. That doesn't make any sense. I haven't been able to figure this part of it out yet, no matter how much John has tried to. But Nick had stopped going about in a circle. He rapidly flailed his hands back and forth and put them under his armpits, and the bluish-yellow streamers of flame went out in a whimsical pink gush of smoke. He bent over to blow on his palms, and while he was leaning forward, something gave, and he toppled headfirst into the grass. Allie got to him first, scooping him up in both arms. His head lolled on a neck that didn't seem to have any bones in it. Allie glared.
He wasn't ready to do that, Allie said. He's been through too much. We should have waited another night. You should have waited. But John Rookwood can take care of himself, Allie said. Nick can't.
And she marched past Harper into the garage.
It was what Allie needed, Harper supposed. A chance to stand up for her brother. To reclaim the role of Nick's protector from Harper. Or at least reclaim a share of it.
I really don't understand, Harper said to Renee. What Allie said just now about Nick being the kindling and the kerosene, that has poetry in it, but it doesn't make a lick of sense.
That's what poetic speech is for the things that are true but don't make sense, for the rough beast and the widening gyre,
Renee said, and she lifted her gaze to stare into the night, where 100 flaming birds turned in a widening gyre of their own before scattering into the stars. 5. Harper found fishing line and a hook in a tackle box under the work table and used them to put 2 stitches in Allie's upper lip. Allie sat rigidly while she sewed, gaze pointed toward the ceiling, eyes welling with angry tears. She made not a sound the whole time. Harper wasn't sure if that was the silent treatment or stoicism. When she was done, Harper worked on Nick. He was deeply asleep, and only frowned while Harper put 4 stitches into his torn forehead. She used the same needle, but she sterilized it by holding it between thumb and forefinger until the steel glowed hot and white. After, Harper went outside to sit on the stoop and watch the clear night sky. Sometimes it seemed that one of the stars came loose from the firmament and sailed off with dizzying speed to a far corner of the night. In the dark hours before sunrise, constellations came apart and reformed and fell in burning streaks. At last, in the gray light of dawn, a small sparrow of fire zigged out of the trees behind the graveyard and exhausted itself in a whiff of smoke. A moment later, the fireman followed it, staggering from the forest and into Harper's arms. The sight of him appalled her. The long gash on his left cheekbone was a ragged line of black gum. The side of his neck was baked red with what looked like an agonizing sunburn. He stank as if he had rolled in the ruin of a campfire. In his left hand swung a steel bucket full of coals.
"I saved her," he gasped. "We need to put her someplace safe and get her some fresh wood."
He gave Harper a frantic look.
"She's starving."
He only reluctantly allowed Harper to pull the bucket out of his hand. The tin handle was hot, maybe searing, but Harper's palm lit softly and she felt no pain. Harper set the pail on the stoop and guided him inside. He passed out almost as soon as she was done sewing up his slashed cheek. She left him on the couch, where he slept with his own turnout coat as a blanket. She went back outside, feeling very tired and very pregnant. The small of her back was a continuous shriek, and she was experiencing sharp pains of a gynecological nature. The bucket of glowing coal sat on the back step, next to the tape deck. Mick Jagger promised he was going home over a strutting bass line. Those coals swelled with brightness, faded and swelled again, matching the rhythms of the song. Harper had an urge to kick the bucket over into the grass. Instead, she carried the pail to a big steel drum, standing in the weeds behind the garage, one in a cluster of garbage cans. She poured the coals in on top of old rubbish, splintered boards, rusting beer cans, oily rags. Flames guttered and jumped, the garbage igniting with a soft, hungry whump. Harper found some sticks and a rotten log crawling with bugs, fed them to the blaze.
"What's that?" Renee asked. "Cook fire?"
"More like one of these fires you like to remember someone by."
"An eternal flame,"
Harper said.
"I hope not."
6. They slept on the couch in shifts, ate the spam, drank the cans of milk. It was hot and close in the garage, stale with the odors of potted meat, concrete, and diesel. They would have to do something about Gil soon. In another day, he would be